This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's the 3rd of May, 1939, in the dressing rooms of Daly Mount Park. There's a star in here, booting up for a final. Today is the FAA Cup final replay between Sligo Rovers and Shelburne. Months earlier, Sligo had managed one of the all-time great transfers in the League of Ireland history. William Ralph Dean, better known as Dixie Dean, was a real superstar of the age. A goal machine for Everton and throughout his career. Once scoring an incredible 60 goals in a single season in top-flight English football. A record that still stands. He's a megastar. He had scored in the previous game in a 1-1 draw, and thousands had come not just for the finals games, but to see him play too. By now, he was in the twilight of his career, but could still smash him in. But Shelburne had their own legend, 35-year-old William Sackey Glenn. He had won 4 league titles and 7 FAI Cups with Shamrock Rovers, and now with Shelburne, he had the chance to win his 8th. And was rewarded by playing in one of the greatest League of Ireland and Shamrock Rovers teams of all time. 2 minutes into the game, Shelburne get a free kick. Up steps Glenn and drills a 30-yard screamer into the net. For the rest of the game, the great Dixie Dean is held at bay. And when the final whistle goes, Shells are FAI Cup champions for the first time in their history. That would be Glenn's final game of his career. He had scored a brilliant winning goal in a cup final in his very last match and left the field with a ringing of applause as he walked down the tunnel one last time. Today, in this game, the star had been outshone. Now I ask you, how can you not be romantic about the cup? And welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Ciarán Curwen, along with Gary Spain. Don't forget you can support us on Patreon for just €5 a month, where we put that money back into the podcast to get more ears listening to us. Just go to patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. That's patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. And please share the podcast on your socials and WhatsApp and spread the word about Green Shoots. So let's get down to this week's show.
So I suppose, Gary, in our last episode, we kind of brought us up to about 1932, 1933 ish, for international and League of Ireland as well. It was, I suppose, that kind of extraordinary history making time international wise as well. You know, we were a fledgling nation, bringing ourselves along on that football journey too. So I suppose maybe outline to us a little bit, where do we find ourselves now, I suppose, in the, you know, the kind of the early to mid-ish kind of 30s?
Yeah, so as we said, we kind of just stopped off there in 1933. So just as a reminder, the Football Association of Ireland was formed in 1921 when the Leinster FA broke away from the Irish Football Association. So 12 years on, I think the league had very much been established. The FAI Cup was ongoing. We were regularly playing interleague games, and we were playing international football at that stage. We'd already notched up 3 wins over Belgium. We'd gone to Amsterdam and beaten the Dutch. We'd drawn with Spain and Barcelona. We'd had some pretty impressive results. We'd also taken a hammering from Spain. And I suppose there's a couple of things to mention about 1933. The first one is that Shamrock Rovers completed an incredible record. They become the first club to win 5 FAI Cups in a row. So they won five FAI Cups. It's only been beaten once, and the only team to beat it was, of course, Shamrock Rovers, who won six in the 60s. But I mean, it is quite an achievement because the FAI Cup hasn't been retained too often either. I think the next club to retain the FAI Cup, apart from Shamrock Rovers, was Cork Hibernians into 1972 and 73. I'm pretty sure on that, but I might need to check it. And it hasn't been retained too often. Now, Shamrock Rovers, they've won 25 FAI Cups, but that team from 29 to 33 was a pretty special team.
Did that communicate into their league form as well? How were they in the league championship, or was that still other major Dublin clubs?
No, so they did win league titles in that period. The other Dublin clubs were also competitive in that period, but Shamrock Rovers did win titles. So, I mean, Shells, Bose, as I'd said in the last podcast, had won pretty much everything in 27-28. Shelburne then won the league and Bose took it off them. Shells won the league again in 31. In 1932, Rovers completed a double. So that was the only double they managed in the five seasons. But they were quite close as well. They were runners-up in the league in 1933. The league, it's also a pretty significant league title as well, because it was the first time provincial club won the league. So all the league titles from 1922 had been won by Dublin clubs. But in 1933, Dundalk won the league for the first time, and they became the first provincial side to win the league. And they won it by a whopping 5 points. It wasn't even close. Mm. And that was quite an incredible achievement by them. Sligo Rovers...
Sorry, just to interrupt, because yeah, I know you're going to move on to Sligo Rovers as well there, but I just wanted to kind of say, is the 30s the growing of the game outside of Dublin? We see a more competitive kind of landscape with teams in, you know, like Sligo and Dundalk. These kind of things begin to emerge where they become competitive now against the bigger Dublin clubs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we talked the last time about the provincial teams winning the cup. So Athlone Town won the cup in 24. Fortson's won it in 26. But what we had after that, Athlone Town unfortunately left the league and didn't return until 1969. But the likes of Dundalk in 1926, Waterford, I think, in 1930, Sligo Rovers, they all joined the League of Ireland, and it became more provincial league. We also had a club in Bray, by the way, Bray Unknowns, and I appreciate the fact that Bray is County Wicklow, and although it can be considered part of the greater Dublin area, is also a provincial side. We'll leave that discussion for another day.
They'll argue that to the house come home, I'll tell you that.
but certainly, the likes of Dundalk winning the league in 1933 was hugely significant, because prior to that, it had been the Shamrock Rovers, the Shelburnes, the Bohemians, St. James's Gate. The league title hadn't left Dublin, and it was the Dublin clubs dominating issues. Now, I should point out, the previous season when Shamrock Rovers had done the double, the next three in the league table were Cork, Waterford and Dundalk. So they were being pushed by provincial sides. But the bigger Dublin clubs prior to 1933 had won the league every season. So I think 1933 on the domestic side was a huge deal with Dundalk winning the league. Now, it didn't last long. Bohemians took the title off them the following year. Dolphin won it. We talked about Dolphin the last time, but they won the league in 1935, and Bohemians won it again in 1936. So it was still, there was a strong Dublin dominance, and you could argue that it's still there to this day, with periods. Obviously, Dundalk have been an incredibly successful club over the years, but the most successful clubs have been the Dublin clubs, and of course Shamrock Rovers in particular.
But it's the growth of that competitiveness, though, isn't it? And I suppose the growth. Am I right in saying the growth in kind of the junior leagues as well?
Yeah, I mean, football had been growing throughout the country at that stage. I mean, it was being played pretty much everywhere. So there was junior clubs being formed, etc. You had League of Ireland clubs in Cork, Dundalk, Waterford and Sligo at that stage. Limerick had still to join the league. But the game was growing and Limerick had a thriving junior scene at the time. So football was definitely growing. We can go on and talk about the national team was certainly improving, making its mark on the world stage as well. The interleague games were hugely prestigious at the time. They were very important, and they meant a lot to people as well. They don't exist anymore. So I think younger people may not even know about them. But
yeah, just explain to us what are interleague fixtures? What competitions? What are they?
So what used to happen in those days was a side would be picked representing the League of Ireland. So you didn't have to actually be Irish. If you were English or Scottish and playing in the League of Ireland, you could represent the League of Ireland. And they played against the Irish League, the Scottish League, the English League, or the Football League as they were known, and the Welsh League. And actually into the 1950s, they played a German team as well from the Hessian League or from the Frankfurt 11, as they were probably known. But so these were hugely prestigious games. It was a big deal to be picked for the interleague. It showed you were among the best players in the league. And these were hugely significant. They drew huge crowds and they were a big deal.
And you mentioned Limerick there as well, which is obviously one that's very close to both of us. But explain to us what we see kind of the, I suppose, an official team or League of Ireland team, etc., grow within, you know, major cities around the country. What's happening in Limerick where that essentially doesn't happen, and they're not getting that kind of that big league team, if you want to put it that way, within the city? Is there just not an appetite for it?
No, I mean, it was actually seen even as far back as 1934. The wheels were put in motion. So they were looking at the success of football in smaller places. I mean, Dundalk, Sligo and Waterford are all smaller than Limerick. Now, it should be said, Limerick rugby has been traditionally strong in Limerick City, and hurling in the whole area around the city is incredibly strong as well. So and they've always been kind of strong competitors. So it had been, it was probably more of a challenge to get senior football into Limerick. But work had been put in place. There was some exhibition games held from 1934 right through the 30s. And the deal was eventually done in 1937 when Dolphin, one of the many Dublin clubs, actually withdrew from the league. They had been incredibly successful. As I said, they'd only won the league 2 years previously. But they ran into some financial issues, which, what a surprise in the League of Ireland. But so Limerick were elected into the league in 1937 in their place. Now, before I even go on to talk about 1937, well, the 36-37 season was pretty significant as well, because the second provincial team to win the league happened in that year when Sligo Rovers won their first league title. And they won it by a convincing margin. They won the league by 10 points. But the top four in the league in 36-37 were all provincial clubs. So Dundalk, Waterford and Brian Nones were second, third and fourth in those days. And Waterford also a hugely significant year in the history of Waterford football, because local man Tom Arrigan captained them to win the FAI Cup. And Waterford have only won two FAI Cups. In 1937, they beat St. James's Gate in the final. And, of course, in 1980, they won the FAI Cup as well, beating St. Pat's. And I'm sure in future podcasts, we'll talk about the great Waterford team of the late 60s and early 70s that won six leagues in eight seasons. But that side failed to win an FAI Cup. So going back to 1937, that FAI Cup win over St. James's Gate was hugely significant. Sligo Rovers taking the league title to the Northwest. And I know maybe I'm banging on a little bit about the provincial clubs and my own Limerick bias and everything. I have to point out the Dublin clubs were normally the ones winning the trophies. But I think it is significant in the history of football and in the history of spreading football around the country that to see these provincial teams winning trophies. Waterford actually won the Shield that season as well. So it was a clean sweep of the major trophies for the provinces.
What do we know about that Sligo team? I mean, you know, I suppose where did the kind of was it a big investment that brings it together? Is it, you know, how do they manage to kind of break this kind of stranglehold of Dublin clubs and manage to do this? What was in the DNA of the club at the time that made that happen?
Well, I mean, I suppose the first thing to point out is Sligo's always been a football town. There's a huge tradition there. It really is. In the town itself, it's the only sport. And it's also, which is great to see, it's not Manchester United or Liverpool they support. It's Rovers. It's the Bitter Red. It's their own team. And they're hugely passionate about their team, their sport. And they've had many, many lean years in Sligo. But boy, do they know how to win trophies, and when they do, they know how to celebrate as well. So they were actually full-time. They had a lot of full-time players in those days. Waterford were full-time as well. And I mean, I think in many ways that was the only way to compete with the Dublin clubs. It would have been very difficult in 1937 to win the league with local players in Sligo or to win the cup with local players in Waterford. So Waterford did have some local players. They also had the best of Cork players as well at the time. They were bringing players in from England and Scotland and from north of the border as well. So it was, a professional setup. There would have been a lot of fundraising involved in those days. There still is in Sligo. And it should go on to talk about, I mean, Sligo won the league in 1937. They went on to reach the cup final in 1939 in one of the most famous cup finals of all. And it's probably rather unkindly known as the Dixie Dean Cup Final because, if you go back to the 1930s and the 1920s...
I got to ask the question. Sorry, give us an introduction to Dixie Dean because he's quite the football. He's a megastar at the time.
Dixie Dean was a megastar. Dixie Dean scored 60 goals. That's 6-0 goals in a top-flight season. You can talk about your Erling Haalands and your Ronaldos and whoever else. Nobody has come even close to that. No. He was a superstar. He was a megastar. Now, by 1939, he was near the end of his days. He'd left Everton. He had joined Notts County. He had finished with Notts County. But he was still a huge draw, and Sligo Rovers signed him in the spring of 1939. They signed him for the Cup, which was actually quite common in those days. And when I say in those days, I remember right into the 70s and 80s when I was going following Limerick in the Markets Field. We'd always maybe hope to sign somebody for the Cup or maybe bring somebody in from England. The league might already be beyond us, but you kind of always have a bit of a dream. You could get a bit of a cup run and you sign somebody. So Sligo signed Dixie Dean.
I think that's technically, is that not a ringer to just bring somebody in for trying to win a couple of games? Is that not the definition of what a ringer is?
I suppose it is, but it was all above board and everything. If you want to talk about ringers, we can maybe talk about the 1935 Cup Final in a minute. But
I'm intrigued.
Let's stick to Dixie Dean in 1939. So he was signed. He was obviously a huge attraction. Think signing Ronaldo, signing Erling Haaland, maybe at the end of their days. But they were a huge name. He scored 5 goals against Waterford in one game for Rovers. So Sligo Rovers, it paid off. They were paying him good money, but they got it back in the gates. They were playing to full houses. They got to the FAI Cup Final against Shelburne and against Val Harris's Shelburne. We talked about Val Harris in the first podcast. a legend of Shelburne, of Irish football. He'd played for Ireland. He'd been on the team that won the home championship in 1914, managed Shelburne to the league title, managed the League of Ireland, managed the national team. He was the Shelburne manager. And the reason I think is probably unfair, Dixie Dean scored in the cup final. They finished in a 1-1 draw. It was played in front of 30,000 people. It generated huge gate receipts for the FAI. Interestingly, and it was actually remarked in contemporary newspapers, the FAI Cup final drew a bigger attendance and had bigger gate receipts than the IFA Cup final that year, which was a bit of a landmark for the FAI because I suppose for many years they'd broken away from the IFA. They'd been seen maybe as second-class citizens, as being a little bit inferior. But that was a big deal to get over 30,000. It went to a replay, and it was a real bonanza for the FAI because there was over 28,000 at the replay on a Wednesday, which, again, was unheard of. And apparently a gate was broken down and maybe another 3,000 got in for free. So
the old-fashioned way.
The old-fashioned way, it happened quite a lot in those days.
If you can't get in, break the gate down.
But it was a huge bonanza for the FAI. And I do want to say, it's known as the Dixie Dean final, and that's a little bit unfair on a man called William Sackey Glenn, who was one of the legends of Irish football, an Irish international, who had played with Shamrock Rovers in the 1922 Cup run, when there's a non-league club got to the final. So Sackey Glenn had won 7 FAI Cup medals with Shamrock Rovers, and he became the first man to win 8 medals that day because he'd had a bit of a row with Shamrock Rovers, had left them and ended up at Shelburne. It was at the end of his days as well, not to mind the end of Dixie Dean's days. But Sackey Glenn, he scored with a free kick early in the game. It was the only goal of the game, and various reports have it from 30 yards or 40 yards. But he definitely meant it. And one of the great free kicks went all the way to the net. And Shelburne won the FAI Cup. Dixie Dean had to settle for a runners-up medal. And it was Shelburne won the cup. And William Sackey Glenn won 8 FAI Cups, which was quite an incredible record.
That is an incredible record. So basically, how long was his career?
Well, he played, so he would have been a youngster in 21-22. So I think that was pretty much the end of his career in 1939. So he would have played for 18 years.
Wow. What a career. How does Dixie Dean end up at Sligo Rovers? Because this is like, this guy is the guy in English football. He has an incredible goal scoring record. Does somebody just front up, does a local businessman or something just front up and say, we will give you whatever you want to get this guy in here?
An important thing to remember in English football, and this existed right up until the 1960s, they had a maximum wage in England. And it was relatively modest at the time. So none of these guys became the mega stars. So they became the mega stars, but they weren't the mega rich people they were today. In Dixie was a classic example. A footballer would save a bit of money during their career, enough to buy a pub and own a pub, and that would sustain them for their retirement. So it wasn't until the 1960s that Jimmy Hill, of Match of the Day fame, I suppose he was chairman of Fulham, and he said he wanted to pay Johnny Haynes, who was another superstar of the 60s of the England and Fulham side, he wanted to pay him £100 a week, which was phenomenal money in those days, because I think the maximum wage, if I remember, it was less than £10 a week. Jeez. So Jimmy Hill wanted to pay Johnny Haynes. They got it abolished. But if you go back to the 1930s, all these players were limited by the maximum wage. That didn't exist in Ireland. So the League of Ireland was able to pay them more money. So the likes of Dixie Dean, later on the likes of Stanley Matthews, Jimmy Delaney, George Best, Jimmy Johnston, some of the superstars of football across the water and further afield, Gordon Banks, ended up playing at least briefly or some for longer. Bobby Charlton played for Waterford. A lot of them played in the League of Ireland. And I suppose the difference in money, there's no chance now that a Ronaldo, an Erling Haaland, a Messi are going to end up in the League of Ireland, because the monies are just, it's just such a different level. Back in 1939, Sligo Rovers were able to offer Dixie Dean more money than he would have ever got at Everton or got at Notts County. They were bringing him in, I'm pretty sure they only brought him in for home games because they got to keep the gate. Mm. If they were, they wouldn't bring him in for an away game because they're only making money for somebody else. Mm. Famously,
he only played 10 games or so for Sligo, didn't he?
Yeah, only a handful of games. He wasn't even available for some. I think he missed a couple of rounds of the cup as well. But even when George Best was being brought in by Cork Celtic in the mid-1970s, they were only bringing him in for home games. They moved their home games to Flower Lodge to accommodate the crowd. But they did a deal with Shelburne. And so when they were playing Shelburne at Harold's Cross, they played George Best if Shelburne gave them so much money and a percentage of the gate. So, I mean, it sounds ridiculous now, but it was perfectly above board. It was all talked about, but we'll play George Best against you if you give us so much money. And that was the negotiations. And
it worked.
The money and the gate, it worked. I mean, there's photographs of Harold's Cross that day when it's actually packed to the rafters, you know. Yeah. And obviously when he played in Flower Lodge, it was the same story.
Mm.
But Dixie Dean, he would have been a megastar, a superstar at the time. That contributed to 30,000 people at the FAI Cup final. And, well, if you actually count the official, the attendance, it was over 30,000 at the replay, but not all of them paid. So it was a huge deal at the time.
Just to raise the question, which was there at the time, I suppose, an Irish equivalent in the 30s. Is there a superstar of the game that everybody knows that everybody wants to play against, you know, etc. etc. Is there that person within the league within the 30s that is that kind of icon, an Irish player?
So there would have been a few players. I mean, that Shamrock Rovers cup team had the great Paddy Moore, who I'll go on to talk about from the national team in that period. But Paddy Moore would have been an icon, a superstar. He got transferred across to Aberdeen in 1932. So there were stars, but if they were excelling, the chances are they were going to be transferred across. I mean, I'm thinking of Jimmy Turnbull, who banged in loads of goals for Cork FC at the time as well. Probably off the top of my head, I'm forgetting some as well. But there were the great Jimmy Dunn, but he would already have left Shamrock Rovers as well. And he didn't. He came back in the late 1930s. So Shamrock Rovers won. I talked about the FAI Cups there. Shamrock Rovers, after Sligo Rovers won the league, Shamrock Rovers won the league for a couple of times. I don't mean to play down the incredible achievements of Shamrock Rovers winning so many titles. Jimmy Dunn coming back was a huge influence in Rovers winning those trophies. So he was a true superstar of the national team. And his goal scoring was absolutely incredible. Part of the great Arsenal team that Herbert Chapman's Arsenal of the 1930s that won three league titles in a row.
Oh, wow. Did not know that. Because Herbert Chapman is considered, I suppose, that one of the, I suppose, the godfathers of tactics, really, isn't he? Who changes the game.
Yeah.
And that's how the Arsenal team goes. And he was playing for him.
So he played for, he won at least one of those league titles, won a charity shield as well. So he was part of that side. He was with Sheffield United as well, who were a decent team at the time as well.
Extraordinary. And I suppose to kind of go back a bit there, we mentioned the 1935 Cup final as well. when we mentioned ringers, and you said, well, if you want to talk about ringers, so what's happening in 1935 Cup Final that we go back to what's going on, what's happening?
So in 1935, the Cup Final might be remembered for one of the highest scoring finals of all time. Bowes beat Dundalk by 4-3. And wow. I don't think that was equaled until Derry played Pats there a few years ago. But Dundalk had actually defeated Shamrock Rovers on the way to the final. And Rovers objected because two of the players on the Dundalk side were playing under false names. And they were actually two top players from north of the border. Maley was one of them, and the other came from Glenavon, whose name escapes me at this point. So Dundalk were playing two ringers. And actually, Maley ended up joining the club legitimately years later. But for their FAI Cup campaign, they had two players playing under false names. Shamrock Rovers couldn't prove it, and they were knocked out of the cup by Dundalk. Bohemians actually beat them in the final, so there was no objection. And
they went absolute full ringer. They were like, these guys, false names, everything.
Absolutely. The names, Gohan was one of the names. I can't remember the other name they played under. They were two different people. Played under the false names. They played in an FAI Cup final. And I suppose, fortunately for those of us who value, I don't know, whatever, ethics and the right thing happening, that Bohemians did actually beat them in the final and win the cup. But Dundalk played two ringers. It was known at the time. It wasn't proven at the time. It was subsequently proven and freely admitted afterwards by people in the club. But
did nobody turn around and say sorry, have you got a passport there, have you got some sort of identification, or was just that kind of thing just non-existent at the time?
I think it was non-existent at the time. It was I know it happened. I'm not going to mention the club in Limerick, but I know, let's say, in the 1980s, we were getting a train to Dublin for the Limerick team used to travel by train for an away match at the time, and a youth side that had actually defeated the Limerick team at the time were going up to play one of the crack Dublin sides, and we were wishing them the best of luck and kind of privately saying, yeah, best of luck and hope you win, and if you lose by less than 6, you're probably doing well. And we met them on the train on the way back. And if I remember rightly, actually, we lost to Shelburne that day, but met them on the train the way back, and they'd won 3-2. Wow, that's incredible. I think it was Cherry Orchard that beat one of the top Dublin sides. And a couple of privately admitted, yeah, we had 6 ringers on the team. So even... And there's a very famous Limerick story, which I can, if I can tell, jump forward to 1975. And so Ballinanti, they had a really great team in 1975, and they actually ended up winning the FAIU Cup. They defeated Wembley of Cork in the final. But in the semi-final, they'd been defeated by a team from Donegal. I can't actually, for the life of me, I can't remember the Donegal team that beat them in the semi-final. But they got word that there was a couple of ringers in the team. And Mick Crowe, who was a legend, he's passed away quite a few years now, but he was a legend in the local football scene, the local pub scene. And he was a larger-than-life character in Limerick, but he'd been involved in senior football for many years. But Mick was involved in Ballinanti. So he goes up to Donegal in the week after the semi-final defeat. First, he goes to one of the families because one of the players had played for Finn Harps, which would have made them ineligible for the Youth Cup. So knocks on the door and says, I'm a scout for Arsenal. And he had seen your little Johnny playing on Sunday in the semi-final. And he wants to send him over on trial. And said, now really impressed with Johnny playing the Youth Cup, but is he any? Oh, Johnny played with Finn Harps earlier in the season, and they produced some evidence that Mick was able to take away with him. that little Johnny was ineligible. And one of the other players was actually overage, and Mick had got wind of that. So he dresses up as a priest, knocks on the door, says he's the new priest in the parish of another house, and manages to get the birth certs of the family, and goes straight to Dublin, lodges the objection on the two players. Ballinanti win the objection, go on and win the FAI Youth Cup. So he mightn't be too popular in Donegal, but
it's incredible. This what is an like, achievement. This is like espionage stuff. It's like spies. It's a Cold War thriller. Yeah.
I think we could actually do a couple of podcasts on Mick Crowe on their own, but an incredible...
By the sounds of it, it would be quite entertaining, I would imagine.
It would be very entertaining, and that's only the ones we could probably talk about. But anyway, he was an absolute legend.
We have to start consulting lawyers on this show? Is this the way it's going to go with solicitors?
let's maybe stop on that. but going back to 1935, Dundalk freely admitted subsequently in subsequent years the research was done, and they did play two ringers in the final. But Bowes did beat them 4-3, so Bowes got the cup. Maybe Shamrock Rovers will feel a little bit aggrieved because they tried to protest having lost to Dundalk in an earlier round. And who knows, but it certainly didn't pay off for Dundalk to win the cup anyway.
Mm. So if we kind of switch our attention then to, I suppose, the national team, in our last episode we kind of saw them kind of come out of the shadows a bit and you know, make themselves known on the world stage in 1924 in the Paris Olympics, and they kind of grew from there. So where are we now, and I suppose almost 10 years later in the mid 30s, and where's the national team?
So we go forward to 1934, and as we said the last podcast, Jules Rimet had organized the 24 Olympics. He organized the first World Cup. The trophy was subsequently called after him. Uruguay was a long way away in 1930. It was being hugely expensive, and the FAI didn't enter. 1934 World Cup was being held in Italy. Now, it was Mussolini's Italy, but different times. But we definitely enter that one. The 1930 had been a huge success. So we entered, but there were more entries than they could accommodate for 16 teams. So we ended up having to qualify. And in 1934, we ended up in a qualifying group with Belgium and the Netherlands, with two of the three countries to qualify. Now, I think it's probably fair to say these back then were not the powerhouses in football they were now. Mm. The Dutch league was still amateur. It remained amateur right up to the 1950s. And we'd actually gone to Amsterdam in 1932 and beaten the Dutch 2-0. We'd already beaten the Belgians three times at that stage, twice in Belgium, and put four goals past them on two of those occasions. So we were actually expected to top the group, and we were expected to qualify. So we had two games. We had Belgium at home and we had the Netherlands away. Belgium came to Dublin, and it was a bit of a letdown. There's a couple of stories and legends attached to that game as well. Some of them not quite true, but there certainly is some truth to one of them. We didn't play well in the first half. We were 2-1 down. We quickly actually went 3-1 down in the second half. But Paddy Moore, who'd scored a goal in the first half, is meant to have been so disgusted at the performance that instead of going to the dressing room at halftime in Dalymount, he went to the bar and had a couple of swift whiskies. There's enough. Maybe it's impossible to verify, but certainly the story has got legs over the years. There's enough people said that he was there in his boots and shorts and gear.
I bet the amount of drinks he took as well extends by one every year.
It probably does. But anyway, if he did have one or two whiskies at halftime, it certainly worked, because he scored a second half hat trick. So we came from behind. We were 2-1 down, 3-1 down, came back to 3-all, 4-3 down, and he got the fourth goal. He got four goals. He became the first man ever to score four goals in a World Cup tie. And we ended up drawing the game 4-4. Now, it was a bit of a disappointment. We felt we should have won. We missed chances, etc. So that set up then the trip in April 1934 to Amsterdam to play the Netherlands. And maybe I probably won't do justice to how big a deal this game was. There were 40,000 people in the stadium. After the event, the Dutch produced two photographic souvenir 16-page A4 booklets packed with photographs and incidents. Two different companies produced two different ones about the game.
Wow.
It was a huge deal. It was a massive game in Dutch football, in world football, with a place in the 34 World Cup at stake. We were leading 2-1 in the second half. A draw would have, as it subsequently proved, would have been enough to qualify us for the World Cup as well. The Dutch equalised midway through the second half, and they scored three goals in the last 12 minutes. Oof. To win the tie, for them to qualify for Italy. And, of course, the defeat knocked us out. It was a gut-wrenching defeat, considering we'd gone there 2 years earlier and beat them 2-0. But it was not to be, and it proved to be Italia 90 before we eventually qualified for a World Cup instead of Italia 34. And
but that was
notwithstanding.
I suppose as well, looking through the history of it, right up into 1930, that was there was kind of a pattern there where on a number of occasions we did come agonizingly close to going to a World Cup, but it just, for whatever reasons, you know, it just didn't materialize.
So following on from the 1934 and the efforts to qualify, we did subsequently again kind of reestablish ourselves, put in some decent performances, get some decent results. We beat Germany in 1936. We went to Budapest and drew with a Hungarian side that was to go on and reach the 1938 World Cup final. And in 1937, we went on a very impressive continental tour. We went to Switzerland first, who were quite a powerhouse in the 30s, and we beat them 1-0. And then a week later, went to Paris and played France in the Stade de Colombe and beat the French 2-0. And it's the only time we've actually managed to beat France away from home. We haven't managed that since. But that was
hugely impressive. Well, you could argue we probably would have if Thierry Henry hadn't stepped in, but there you go.
that's another podcast on its own. But anyway, yeah.
Thierry's hand.
Yeah. Absolutely. And one could argue that was in extra time and we had in 90 minutes. But anyway, we'll go on. But certainly that the only official win we've ever had over France on French soil was that 2-0 win in 1937. So after those wins, our next games were actually in qualification for the 38 World Cup. It was ourselves or Norway in a straight shootout. So we played Norway home and away, with the winners going to the 1938 World Cup. And again, we were hot favourites for that. We were expected to win. And this was a particularly bad letdown because Norwegian football was pretty weak at that stage. They didn't actually qualify for another World Cup till 1994 when they actually met us.
Hmm.
But in 1938, we went to Oslo and we were beaten 3-2, a late goal, very disappointing result. We would have expected to beat them. Still, we had them coming back to Dublin. We were expected to turn it around. We obviously needed a two-goal win at this stage. And unfortunately, we couldn't do it. We drew 3-3. Wow. Conceded some bad goals, and it was Norway who went to the World Cup and we stayed at home, and that World Cup was in France, so it would have been very close. It would have been a huge deal in those days for us to have qualified for the World Cup. And I think both 34 and 38 are ones that got away, considering we had so many impressive international results during that period.
And
as I said, the win over Germany, the win away to France, away to Switzerland, etc.
Is there any accounts of perhaps why that is? Because it sounds kind of a bit like we were pretty good, but we just kind of bottled it a little bit when the pressure was on. Is that unfair?
Yeah, I don't know if it's bottled it. I mean, it was different times and the preparations wouldn't have been as good. But certainly the newspaper reports, particularly of the Norway games, would have been pretty scathing. You know, they were games we should have won. We should have qualified. Maybe with hindsight, Belgium and the Netherlands were probably a bit better. We took them for granted, and maybe they upped their game because of the World Cup was at stake as well. And in reality, the Dutch game only got away from us in the last few minutes in Amsterdam, and they were being roared on by a 40,000 crowd, which certainly would have had its impact and would have made a big difference in those days. I suppose I went on. I mean, the Czechoslovakia team that got to the 34 final, we drew away to them as well. The Hungary team that got to the 38 final, they came to Cork in 1939, the first ever international, home international outside of Dublin. And we drew with them in the Mardyke. So we were competitive with some of the best teams in Europe. But when it came to actually getting over the line and even qualifying for the tournaments, we definitely fell short in 1934 and 1938.
And it mirrors a lot of the subsequent decades up until, I suppose, 1990, where we almost definitely had the talent. You know, that was not the question at hand. We certainly seemed to have the talent of players to go over and make these kind of results happen, but it just didn't. We just didn't happen for us, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many hard luck stories. I'm sure we'll go on and talk about them in qualifying for major tournaments. I should go on and mention a couple of more things about the 1930s. And one of the things was a dispute which seems to be of the FAI's making with the IFA. So obviously we broke away from the IFA and we mended fences a bit. They came to Dublin. We played interleague games in 1926, 27. We played regularly until 1930. And I'm not exactly clear on this, and I have done some research. There was a falling out, and the FAI refused to allow our clubs to play against Irish League clubs in friendlies. A lot of these matches had happened up until 1930, and the interleague games also stopped at that time. And somewhere in 1937, the bridges were mended, and the person I think had a major influence in this, because the newspapers have always been a bit sketchy on this. It's a gentleman by the name of Toby Mercer, who had actually played for Ireland back at the turn of the century. He became an administrator, a legend in Glentoran football, because it was him that saved the Oval. It had been bombed. The Oval was bombed in 1941 and it was totally destroyed. And the club nearly folded. The ground was totally destroyed. It took them 8 years to get back. It was his casting vote. But Toby Mercer's portrait hung in the League of Ireland offices in the 1940s. And from the best I can research and find out, he is probably one of the main men that actually talked, build the bridges with Dublin and got the clubs playing matches again. It certainly was huge. I know Dundalk were actually quoted in 1937 saying it was huge for them to be able to play their friendly matches against the likes of Portadown, Glenavon Distillery, etc. Being a border club, there would have been a lot of players going back and forth across the border. And of course, the two ringers from 1935 were actually Northern players as well. But
and what's the cause of this? I suppose the split part two, if you want to put it that way, what's happened in did somebody say something? Was there a fixture problem? Why?
No, I can't really get to the bottom of it. What it is, it seems to have been on the FAI side, because the IFA welcomed the decision by the FAI to allow the clubs to play, and there was certainly stuff saying we always wanted our clubs to play. They rearranged the interleague games, came back on in 1938, and they continued right through the war and everything. But so it's not quite clear what it was. It certainly disadvantaged our clubs, and But certainly for much of the 1930s, our clubs and our interleague teams didn't play against each other. We still played matches against the Welsh League. And they were so... We played the Irish League and the Welsh League in the 1920s. We only had games at an interleague level against the Welsh League in the 30s. And then famously in 1939, which is one of the great days in Irish football, but one of the forgotten days of Irish football, in the Scottish League came to Dublin for the first time on St. Patrick's Day in 1939. And it was a star-studded Scottish side. They were valued at £100,000, which was a phenomenal amount of money in those days. Wow. And there is a legend, which I can't quite verify, that the Scottish manager had told the players not to embarrass the host too much and not to score more than 13. But now maybe that's got a bit embellished over time. But on a very famous day for Irish football, the League of Ireland defeated the Scottish League by 2-1.
Yeah.
And a man who was a key man in the Shelburne winning the cup, playing in the replay, was a winger by the name of Tom Priestley, who was also a key player on that League of Ireland side. Incidentally, for someone who played in the League of Ireland at that stage, he was a very religious man and he refused to play on a Sunday. So he could only play in the FAI Cup final replay because it was on a Wednesday. And the interleague game was played on St. Patrick's Day 1939, which actually wasn't a Sunday. I think if I remember correctly, the Hungary game was played the following Sunday in Cork, which was around the 19th of March or so. And it's also probably fair to say there was a bigger crowd, and even drawing with the team that had reached the World Cup final a year earlier was not as big a deal as beating the Scottish League 2-1 in Dalymount Park that day. So that win was a huge deal. It was a huge boost for Irish football. Particularly, it was the first Scottish visit to Dublin. The national team wouldn't come until 1961. Mm. And although we did play them regularly at interleague level after World War II.
And is this the significance of that result? Is that celebrated at the time as well? Is this, are people like, this is huge, let's have a party?
Absolutely. There were wild celebrations in Dalymount Park that day. It was considered a huge win. It got fantastic press. And it was a hugely significant day. I mean, it was a very prestigious game. It was a huge deal to be picked for the League of Ireland. It was a big deal to be picked for the Scottish League in those days as well. And I mean, remember, the Scottish League would have seen itself probably, maybe they would have seen themselves on a par with the Football League as it was at the time. And the Scottish national team would certainly have considered themselves on a par, if not better than the England team. So this was a huge deal. To actually beat that side was a pretty big deal.
Just a question on similar lines. The manager for the League of Ireland 11 and Scottish 11, etc., who is that? Is that picked by the governing boards, or is it like, I suppose, the manager of the winning league team gets to be manager? Who was the manager, and how did they decide who the managers of these sides who would be?
Okay, so just to explain, in those days, the team was picked by selectors.
Okay.
So there would have been a selection committee of 3 or 5 who would have sat down to pick the team. And they would have got a coach or a trainer to manage the team. I actually don't know who was the manager in 39. Against the Scottish League. I'd have to look that one up.
No, it's just interesting.
The manager wouldn't have been that big a deal, I suppose, in that they wouldn't have any say on who played. They just had to cope with whatever players they were given.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you two questions as well before we wrap up. One, I suppose, was this is, of course, the decade of the Great Depression. In the United States as well, there's a, I suppose, an economic shockwave that kind of envelops the world. Does the League of Ireland get caught up on that, because there's company teams as well?
Certainly, Ireland in the 1930s was still very poor. I mean, we were largely dependent on agriculture.
Mm.
The country was still, I suppose, well behind. But having said that, in football terms, I talked about we had full-time teams. I think the wages in Waterford, they were getting £3 a week in 1937. A couple of the star players, O'Keefe from Cork, was on £4 a week. But that was quite a lot of money in the 1930s to be a full-time professional footballer. So there was some money around, and there were certainly huge crowds going to the games, but football was quite cheap to attend. It was only a couple of pence to go to games. And I suppose the country, Ireland as a country, took a long time to develop. Emigration would still have been high. I mean, that went right through into the 40s, into the 50s. It was really only in the 60s and the Sean Lamass government that kind of transformed this state and, I suppose, brought levels of prosperity that we would know today to the country. So it was very different times. There would have been a lot of poverty in the country. But having said that, football was incredibly strong, and there was a number of full-time professional footballers.
Mm. I wanted to ask you as well, because we're moved now into the kind of the late 30s as well. The spectre of World War II rears its head in the late 30s. You've got fascism, of course, across Europe. You've got Germany, Italy, Spain, Franco Spain as well. So is there an awareness, I suppose, in the late 30s in international football that there's a spectre kind of overreaching everybody at the time, or is that, I suppose, does that come later as World War II actually really kicks off?
No, there is an awareness. I think you would be wrong to say there wasn't. And I mean, so we actually visit. So we famously beat Germany in 1936. And I suppose the FBI do get some criticism because the program cover actually has the swastika on the cover. But if you actually look at program covers from that period, we also had the Swiss flag. We had the national flags on the covers of the program. So it wasn't as such. But we did visit Germany. We went to Dortmund in 1935 and went to Bremen, actually, in 1939. And the Irish team were famously asked to give the fascist salute before the game. And Jimmy Dunn actually famously refused, which was quite a brave thing to do in 1930s Germany. Jimmy Dunn would have been a very staunch Republican. I talked about him as being one of the great footballers. He was also, he had very strong Republican views. I suppose there was a lot of Irish Republicans would have gone to Spain in the 1930s to fight against Franco.
Against Franco, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And they would have obviously been opposed to Hitler and Mussolini, etc. I know you can go on and talk. Subsequently, Irish Republicans sided with Hitler during World War II, but that's maybe another story and maybe for a totally different podcast. But certainly, Jimmy Dunn very bravely refused to give the fascist salute in Germany. And it would be very hard to blame his teammates for doing it, because in those times you didn't know what would happen.
Mm.
But Europe was very different. I mean, Italy won the 34 and 38 World Cups.
That's right, yeah.
They were seen as being a triumph for Mussolini's Italy. They had hosted the 34 World Cup. They had gone to France in 38 and won it as well. Germany actually had already incorporated a lot of the Austrian Wunder team of the early 30s into the Germany side that played in the late 1930s into the 1940s.
Well, interesting times as we move I suppose, into the late 30s and the early 40s as well. I suppose, given that, Gary, next time I think we're going to cover another, I suppose, tumultuous world event, football during World War II, but perhaps less tumultuous for us on this corner of the world, but still, you couldn't ignore what was happening around the world at the time, so that'll be an interesting discussion. Until then, Gary, thanks very much. Another fascinating look at the League of Ireland in the 30s and what a time it was. Ringers, espionage, great players, great teams as well. So, Gary, thanks very much. Until next time.
Thanks, Gail. Yep.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Don't forget you can support us on Patreon for just €5 a month, where we put that money back into the podcast to get more ears listening to us. Just go to patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. That's patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. Please share the podcast on your socials and WhatsApp and spread the word about the show. Remember to support your local League of Ireland club. It's our heritage. It's our game. Until next week, bye for now.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.